I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. In 2008, the entire U.S. financial system collapsed, largely due to unfettered greed and regulators asleep at the wheel. The effect has been catastrophic for those who lost their jobs, their pensions, and much of their hope for the future. And yet, the justifiable anger over this crime was redirected toward big government and President Obama. The very wealthy, including the traitors who brought down the financial system, were cast as the victims in a so-called class war. And conservatives staged a comeback when, our guest argues, their policies and platform should have been discredited. So what happened? How did the birth of the Tea Party movement change the conversation? And how is the Occupy movement challenging that narrative? Joining us today is Thomas Frank. He's a columnist with Harper's Magazine and author of Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He also wrote the book What's the Matter with Kansas? And we also want to take your calls. What's your assessment of the Tea Party movement? What's your response to the State of the Union address last night? Did the billionaires manage to change the debate to avoid regulation and the revival of progressive policies? Has President Obama been effective in messaging about the banking system, the financial collapse, and the mortgage meltdown? And how is the Occupy movement changing the conversation? You can call us at 866-798-TALK. That number again is toll-free, 866-798-8255. Or you can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Welcome to Your Call, Thomas.
It's great to be here, Holly.
So you say that the 2010 comeback of the right was highly unlikely and that, quote, these people should be discredited like Hoover. The old order was discredited by the actions of the Bush administration. And yet here they are dominating the debate and taking an unprecedented number of congressional seats in the midterm election of 2010. So take us quickly through your kind of thesis about what happened here, this kind of misplaced outrage that you talk about.
Yeah, well, I'm not the only one that thinks that this was that 2008 was the end for conservatism. This was something that you saw very widely in pundit land. I was actually one of the people that was more, I know something about the conservative movement, and I knew it was not going to roll over and die, of course. But there were plenty of pundits out there who were saying, you know, because of the massive unpopularity of their hero George W. Bush, and because you know his administration had led us into disaster after disaster, culminating with the economic catastrophe of 2008. That this was the end of the road for conservatism. Their economic policies, you know, we'd been doing this for 30-odd years, the bank deregulation and all the different, in all the different ways that manifested itself. And look what it had gotten us. Look what it had fetched us. It was, incredible disaster. And obviously, the pundits thought, obviously the country had to change direction. Okay. So here we are, and then several years later. And what happens? The conservative movement has built this fantastic sort of fake populist movement out there in the street. And they, they go from strength to strength and they win this massive victory in the 2010 elections, calling for precisely the things that got us into trouble last time around, by which I mean deregulation, roll government back more. And they managed to shift the blame for the disaster onto government entirely. And by the way,
onto the homeowners.
And to a lesser degree onto homeowners. And this is a theme that comes up throughout. And by the way, and I talk to these guys. I've been on radio shows for the last couple of weeks, and they're always calling in and absolutely convinced that this is right. And there's an important thing to remember about these guys, Holly. They don't talk to us like, say, the billionaires of old, like in the 1930s or something like that, telling us to get back in our place and this is how society works and that sort of thing. They do it in a populist way. You look at a guy like Newt Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich plays right into your whole thesis.
I couldn't have invented Newt Gingrich.
Newt
should have been Newt should be a fictional character. There's no way that there's a man like that. Okay, I'm sorry, that's not fair. But Newt Gingrich's his victory speech in South Carolina the other day, he denounced elites in this speech so many times. I was on a radio show just now where I had a caller. I had referred to a favorite conservative book of 2010. It was called The Ruling Class. It's like Marxism for conservatives or something. It's actually a pretty good book. This is and the caller, by the way, was really angry that I had disagreed with the book's thesis. He's like, there is too a ruling class in this country, and it's, you know, liberals, and they're, you know, and this is a very widely held belief. But so we, you know, everybody's talking today about President Obama's populism, his very daring populism, in that he, you know, he's calling for a higher tax rate on the wealthy, which is, you know, actually in the, deep in the American grain, you know, progressive income tax, but. The right, one of the reasons that the right is so struck by, you know, is so worried about his populism and his class warfare is that they've had that field all to themselves for 3 years now. They own class warfare. They have been doing it without anybody contradicting them on and on and on and on, and very successfully.
And it doesn't seem like the facts tend to matter. I was reading an article this morning from Alternate by Joshua Holland, and it says, I haven't fact-checked this, but more American families went on food stamps during George W. Bush's term in office than under any other president in history, almost 500,000 more than under Barack Obama, and that's during this huge financial economic collapse.
Well, of course, that's right. Well, I mean, I don't.
And we're
referring to the fact that
Newt Gingrich has been calling Obama the food stamp president.
Well, he's doing that to get the sort of 70s juices flowing again. This idea that food stamps are this illegitimate thing. You know, it's that's why he's doing it. It is hard, but at the end of the day, it is hard times. Okay, we've been in this terrible economy for 4 years now, since the tail end of 2007, and it just gets worse, and it never, it's not getting worse any longer, but it sure isn't getting better very quickly.
Well, some people are saying that it is getting better.
Well, I'm saying it is getting better, but not very quickly.
Right.
It's this very, very slow recovery, which is what you apparently... what happens after, you know, after a financial crisis. And, you know, there's no getting around that. The thing is that how are you going to speak to that politically? And I think Barack Obama's done up until now, I mean, maybe he's turned a corner now, he's done a lousy job at speaking, getting out in front of that public anger. I mean, how can you look back at the things that happened in the 1930s during the last go around, you know, where Franklin Roosevelt came in and promised to reform the system. He would give us social insurance so that even if it did happen again, we'd be okay. You know, and that he would throw these rascals out. Look at what's happened in our system. The people that were running the investment banks then are the same people running them today. We haven't broken up the investment banks. We've barely laid a glove on them. You know, the Republicans were able to block one of the really great things that Obama has done is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, and they were able to block that from even getting started here until very, very recently. And not Obama's fault, of course. That's, you know, but he should have fought for it a lot more vigorously. But
so your big criticism with Obama is not getting out in front of the financial crisis and talking to Americans about what caused it and what he was going to do.
That's
for
right. And he also embraced the bailout policy of the previous administration. He embraced the Bush administration's bailout policy, which I think was,
which is now being attributed to him by.
That's right. He owned it. I mean, he voted for it, the TARP, and he appointed Tim Geithner, who had been the point man on that, to run his Treasury Department. He'd been the point man on the Federal Reserve's bailout of AIG, appointed him to run the Treasury Department. And when he did that, and this is sort of my critique of Obama, he did that in what he thought was the noblest spirit of bipartisanship. This was statesmanlike.
Well, and that's how he started out this presidency, was really trying to have that tone.
Exactly. Always. And, you know, you remember his great speech at the Democratic Convention in 2004, where he talked about, you know, there is no red America, there is no blue America. And when I heard that, when I heard the speeches that he was giving in 2008 about bipartisanship, I thought, you know, all presidents do that. All presidential candidates do that. And I sort of brushed it off. And what I've discovered since then is that was, for him, that was not ornament. That was essence. That was structural. That's what he really thinks. He becomes president at this sort of Franklin Roosevelt moment. The economy in ruins. The old order has discredited itself in the most massive way. And he thinks the real problem facing us is partisanship. It's that people are mean to one another in Washington, D.C.
It is a real problem.
I don't know. I live there. It is
gridlock.
A problem. I mean, well, I'll say this. Partisanship is stupid. You know, it is stupid. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, he was the moment for him was like he could have gone so far beyond that. It's not just partisanship. It is the entire, you know, Wall Street based civilization of ours that we had entrusted ourselves to for 30 years since the dawn of the Reagan Revolution had collapsed. And he needed to come out there and tell us that. And, you know, instead of doing what he did, which was prop it right back up.
So what I'd like to do is go back to the beginning of the Tea Party movement. You were there at the first Tea Party rally, and you had
what I think was the first
what you
Tea
think
Party.
Was
they argue over what was the first
what
one.
Was the,
yeah.
Well, but so just talk about what your observations of that first rally were, and
all right,
and then we'll talk about the Koch brothers.
There's well, a lot of the and then we'll get to the infernal Wichita. You know, the okay,
it's
my
always
fellow
about
Kansas,
Kansas,
it always
isn't
comes
it?
Back
yeah.
to Kansas, doesn't it? They that first Tea Party rally, this is in February of 2009. So it was less than a month after Barack Obama had been sworn in. And it was about a week after Rick Santelli had done his famous rant on the floor of the Chicago Board of Trade. And I was at the time writing a column for The Wall Street Journal. And I had been looking for expressions of hard times outrage. This was this is what I wanted to do with my life. Or with my column anyway, was go around the country and sort of document in the way that Edmund Wilson did back in the 30s to document hard times outrage. And the first example that I'm able to come up with is, lo and behold, this Tea Party rally. And I went to it and I thought it was ridiculous because it was all of these sort of conservative movement hacks. It was all, you know, people I just written a book about the conservative movement in Washington, D.C., all the, you know, the think tanks and the lobby shops and the magazines, you know, and there is this conservative side to Washington, D.C. that we never think about, but it's there. And it was all these guys I'd been writing about were at this rally, you know, and there was Joe the Plumber was there, you know, and various celebrity bloggers were there. And it was so clearly a put up job. You know, it was AstroTurf.
You think it was orchestrated?
It definitely was. These guys said this was the conservative movement, the leadership of it, calling this rally. And there, you know, the people attending it all had name tags on because they'd come over from, you know, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which was in town that day. And so it definitely was. The funny thing was that it caught on. After that first one, it caught on, and a few
and became an authentically populist movement.
I think so. Its politics are not. It's not authentic in the sense that its politics are exactly the opposite of traditional populism, but it's populist in the sense that it is grassroots. It looks and sounds populist. They're very angry at the powers that be, at the ruling class, as they like to say, and so it became something that was sort of authentic, sort of genuine over time. So later ones that I went to were more authentic. It's still, I mean, we could talk about this all day if you want. It's still pretty funny stuff.
Well, but I want to get to some of the substance of this. You say that the Koch brothers were actually involved with orchestrating some of this. And,
well,
and billionaires
trying to
switch the narrative, you know, to say that it's this class war, the bankers are being vilified, the traders are just common people.
Well, yes, but I wouldn't attribute all of that to the Koch brothers. There's a lot of geniuses out there on the American right. They don't always need to be, you know, taking the orders of David and Charles Koch. You know, you think of guys like Dick Armey, who runs FreedomWorks. He's a smart guy. He can play the game really well. Newt Gingrich can play the game. Newt was, by the way, was
as
backing.
As he's proving right now.
That's right. But his group was backing that first Tea Party rally. He's been there since the creation. He's a very canny political player. And D.C. is filled with guys like that. They know what they're doing. But the Koch brothers support two of the biggest Tea Party groups, Americans for Prosperity and whatever Dick Armey's group is called, FreedomWorks or something like that. And they've also, you know, this movement really reflects a lot of their sort of libertarian priorities. In fact, it's a lot more libertarian than other sort of right-wing flowerings that we've had. Let's just take a moment there and stop, Holly. Right-wing flowerings. This is the fourth one since I was born. You had Nixon in 68. You had the late 70s, what they called the New Right, and then culminating in Reagan. You had the Gingrich Revolution, ending the liberal control of Congress since the 30s. And now you've got another one. And it's always, you know, for these guys, this the conservative p- politics are always fresh, always new. It's never been tried before. Nobody's ever thought to cut red tape on bankers before. Hey, what a great idea. Nobody's ever thought, you know, we need to roll back taxes, across the board, and especially at the highest levels, because those are the job creators. Ingenious. It's never been tried.
So it sounds like as you were writing this book,
I'm
the Occupy.
Cynical. I apologize.
Yes, you are very cynical, and I am not. So I can balance you out. But as you were writing this book, it seems like the Occupy movement was born. What is your and so there's some, you know, some analysis of the Occupy movement. But what's your take on that movement and whether it was spontaneous or orchestrated?
Well, we know who came up with the idea for that, right? It was Callie Lazin and the Adbusters guys, and I mean, it was. But this is far more spontaneous. There's not a lot of money behind it. It's not like all the liberal groups in D.C. were out there protesting in the park. This started at a park in Lower Manhattan, and they really did sort of put their bodies on the line in a really uncomfortable way, you know, camping out, sort of setting up a kind of Hooverville situation. So I think it's there's no question about it, that it's more authentic. The significance of Occupy Wall Street, and I can't emphasize this enough, but one of the reasons that the Tea Party movement succeeded and that the right has succeeded and gone as far as they've gone is because there was no other voice out there. If you wanted to protest bailouts, if you wanted to protest, you know, what they used to call banksters, and what the Tea Party movement does, that's what they call them, you only had one choice. And it's this sort of upside-down libertarian message that they have. But that is nonetheless filled with class anger, filled with just, you know, fury at having been ripped off by the system, you know, and that speaks to hard times outrage. You only had one choice, and it was those guys. Well, today, you've at least got some competition for that, and that's very important. Now, that said, Occupy Wall Street has a long, long, long way to go until they get to where they need to be, which is they need to become part of people's lives. You know, there were a lot of, I look back to there were similar movements in the 1930s, and there were also movements that were just expressions of desperation. Okay, like I think of the Bonus Army, which also camped out in a public
bonus
place.
March, yeah. Bonus
and, yeah, in 32, they went to Washington D.C., and it was a tragic sight, and they did not get what they wanted. It wasn't it was not a really successful thing, and what they mainly did.
They ultimately did.
They got their bonus,
yeah.
I think, years later.
Yeah.
But it dramatized their desperation.
And in some ways, it led to the creation of the GI Bill.
Good point. Many years down the road.
Many
exactly.
Years down the road.
But see, this thing has to move and move and move, and it has to become the real thing that changed the 1930s. I'm sorry, you want me to be quiet? I'm going to be quiet.
No, I want to get back to. I will get back to the 30s in just a moment. I want to invite our callers to join this conversation and get a chance to talk with Thomas Frank, who is the author of Pity the Billionaire: The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and you can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. We want to know what you think of the thesis that the billionaires were able to essentially change the conversation around the financial collapse. We also are wondering, how's the Occupy movement changing the conversation? And what are the similarities between the Tea Party movement and the Occupy protests? You can call us at 866-798-TALK. Again, that number is 866-798-8255. Our guest is Thomas Frank. And okay, so let's get back to the 30s before we go to our callers. So that was a nightmare time for the right. You argue that they were trying to avoid a replay of what happened in the 30s. So
look at it this way. Some people think of the Depression, as an awful time because people were on bread lines and people lost their jobs, and it was just a terrible time economically. Other people think the 30s was a terrible time because that's when they got regulated. That's when they had to start paying high taxes. That's when
big government
their workers formed
took over
a union.
America.
Yeah, that's exactly. So for some people, that's the nightmare of the 30s, not financial hard times. And what's funny is that, and you have people like one of the Koch brothers, I forget which one, but I've got a good quote from him in Pity the Billionaire, where he wrote in their company newsletter that basically this is what we're looking at. We're looking at a return to the 1930s and all the terrible things that happened then, by which he did not mean bread lines and high unemployment, by which he meant
Regulatory Glass-Steagall Act and
all these terrible things are coming back. And so they what's funny is that these two fears, the fears of, on the one hand, essentially the billionaire class, they were able to cast their fear as the fear of average people. And they were really able to scramble these categories, and they did it very effectively. I mean, this is what Pity the Billionaire is. It's a story of just rampant cultural and political confusion.
So then do you think it's that Americans are ahistorical? I mean, there's a kind of an irony with Newt Gingrich, who likes to quote history, and yet he seems to have amnesia about the Iraq War and the huge debts racked up under. It's over.
Well, hey, but Newt also, he does this very well. We're talking about people, the right essentially mimicking hard times protest movements. And have you seen the ads that Newt is running against Romney in South Carolina? I mean, it's like social realism or something. And if it wasn't for this little sort of fig leaf of conservative, sort of doctrinaire conservative dogma, orthodoxy that he applies on top of it, like, well, we all love capitalism, but this kind of capitalism, I don't know. You know, if it wasn't for that, you'd say this is like, Newt is like way to the left of all these other guys, you know, because on the surface, that's what it sounds like. He is stealing an old leftist sort of meme.
And do you think that there is a coherent conservative philosophy, or are you just a total right basher?
No, I think there definitely is. I think it's much more coherent even than the left. A lot of what I've been describing is pure opportunism, but there is that. But by and large, I would go further than that. I'd say that there is a conservative utopianism out there. These guys really do think that someday, you know, if we just deregulate more, if we just cut taxes more, if we roll the state back more, we will finally reach this sort of free market, free market Valhalla or free market Arcadia, where everything works the way that our economics textbooks assured us it would work. Everything will work the way the theories tell us it should work. And what's amusing about this is that, of course, we've just come through a 30-year experiment in that very ideology, and it's failed and failed. And the closer we get to that utopia, the more it fails. But these guys are like, no, we just haven't gone far enough. And this is their response to when I talk about...
And it's working.
It's selling, you mean?
It's selling.
Yeah,
yes.
It's not going to work. I'm here to tell you.
Well, we know that it doesn't work because we've got, 30 years of history to give us a sense of how we got into this collapse
mess
in the first place.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. But no, that's always the response is no, we just haven't gone far enough. If we just deregulate more and get government completely out of the picture.
And we're talking with Thomas Frank. He's a columnist with Harper's Magazine and author of Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. And we'll take your calls right after we go to this break. We've got a full bank of callers. We're talking about the economic collapse of 2008 and how the narrative around what happened shifted in 2010. Frank says the right was able to dominate the populist debate despite the fact that GOP policies were directly responsible for the debacle. And we want to take your calls. You can join us when there's an open line at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. What's your assessment of the Tea Party movement, and how do you define it? Did the billionaires manage to change the debate to avoid regulation and the revival of progressive policies, a new New Deal? And has President Obama been effective in messaging about the banking system, the financial collapse, the mortgage meltdown, and what's happening to ordinary Americans? I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
Time is 10:30 here on local public radio, KALW San Francisco, on this, the opening day of our January membership campaign, a great day to support local public radio. It's easy at KALW.org, where you'll find gifts to thank you for your support, as well as plenty of information about the station. The goal for this membership campaign is $100,000. and no interruptions in the programming. Your contribution today will help us get rolling. KALW.org. Please go to the website, KALW.org. Thank you.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And tomorrow, we'll talk about relations between the U.S. and Iran. How alarming is the standoff between Iran and the West, and how are sanctions impacting Iran's economy? Friday, of course, is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about the week's news coverage. And today, we're talking with Thomas Frank, author of Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. Frank says the right was able to dominate the populist debate despite the fact that GOP policies were directly responsible for the debacle. You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK, or you can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And I want to get right to your call, so let's go to Nancy in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Call, Nancy. Nancy, are you there? All right. Well, then let's go to Dominic in San Francisco. Hi, Dominic. Welcome to your call. Can you turn down your radio?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to just start by thanking Mr. Frank for his observation and analysis over the last few decades. My question really is about how it is that the conservative movements, the conservative resurgence that we've observed over the last few years, but really, in my view, the whole conservative movement more generally continually gets away with spreading misinformation and lies. I mean, as I observed the sort of Republican presidential candidate debates in recent months, I feel like I'm just watching a few hours of people lying to the American public. And the puzzling thing to me is that on the one hand, the larger public and the folks that support this movement don't seem to grasp or are not willing to understand facts versus lies, and how it is that our press corps is so feeble that they leave these things, allow these things to go unchallenged.
Thanks, Dominic. Isn't that the question of our era? I mean, that really is it. Hey, by the way,
do facts even matter anymore?
No, I'll get to that in a sec, but I want to mention, you know, I'm speaking tonight in Berkeley.
Oh,
did you know this?
I didn't know this.
At the Hillside Club tonight.
The Hillside Club tonight in Berkeley. And at what time?
I don't know, 7 or something like that.
Okay, well, we'll find that information and we'll put it at yourcallradio.org.
Tomorrow, I'm going to speak at the Commonwealth Club right here in Washington, D.C. But no, this is San Francisco, California.
He's got jet lag, folks.
Okay, the question about these guys, and I totally agree with the caller, when you watch these people, it's like they're in a parallel universe. Like I was watching it the Republican debate the other day, the four remaining candidates, and you know they're one after another asserting that government caused the housing bubble and caused the financial crisis, and this has been not just debunked, been dynamited time and again by all the sort of journalists and researchers that have looked into this subject. This is something that I know a great deal about, and it's astonishing to me that they're able to assert this so confidently. Okay. It takes us, though, to this larger problem of people living in a kind of world of their own. And this is where we are today. I mean, we all know the sort of sociological truism about people self-segregating into neighborhoods made up of people like themselves. But you can also do that. I mean, that's what the internet is for.
Of course, the argument is made that progressives are doing that as well.
That's right, yeah. And that's what the internet is for. I mean, the internet allows you to really withdraw from this common world. And, I mean, the death of the newspaper is certainly pushing matters along in this regard. I mean, the one of the great things about a newspaper is that, you know, there it all is on the front page. You don't get to pick and choose what news you want to read and what you don't. If you want to live in a world of half truths and falsehoods, the daily newspaper makes that very difficult. And with the almost complete demise of the daily newspaper, by the way, one of the conservative slogans, this is one of the groups that's supporting the Tea Party movement, has, or you see their signs all over the place. I saw them in news photos from New Hampshire. Their slogan is "Don't believe the liberal media," and by liberal media they mean media. Essentially, do not
believe everything except Fox News.
That's basically, yeah. But don't believe the evidence of your senses. Now, this is very interesting. And when I saw this, this got me thinking. Is this there is a 30s parallel here as well.
Absolutely.
And
the,
this is
the invention of the modern smear campaign started with Upton Sinclair's
bid for
the governorship.
That's right. But
California.
I was actually thinking of self-deception, because what you're talking about here is a group of people that have withdrawn into this world of their own. And there is sort of classic historians of the 1930s would often talk about the 30s as an age of faith, or something worse, as an age when people who were, and these would people be on the political extremes, would convince themselves of this kind of utopian world that they were reaching out towards. And I'm specifically talking about communists here, American communists, and they could brush off everything they heard about the Soviet Union. This is famous. Like, there's a famine in the Ukraine, the famous man-made famine under Stalin. And they're like, American communists are like, no, that's not happening. And they would hear those Moscow show trials on the radio, and they'd be like, yeah, that's a fair trial right there. You know, these sort of crazy things that they're famous for, until, of course, the day of the Hitler-Stalin pact, and then they all changed their mind. But you see that same kind of deliberate self-delusion in the conservative movement today, with, I mean, a million times more importance for our political system. I mean, the Communist Party was always just a tiny little outlier. These guys,
except in the 30s.
Well, but even then, I mean, their candidates didn't do that well, is what I was saying.
Well, Upton Sinclair was doing quite well. He ran as a Democrat, but he was a socialist.
That's right. But he wouldn't be one of those guys I would consider in this world of delusion. He was a reality-based community.
I want to get to more of our callers, but can you just talk for a moment about the parallels with the 30s? And I'm actually thinking specifically of, you know, we exalt Roosevelt, FDR, for what he did with the New Deal, et cetera. But really, he was the one who saved capitalism. I mean, he was criticized from the left in the same way that Obama is today.
Yes, but okay, good point. So that puts me in a spot, because of course Roosevelt is my great hero, and the one who always the people who had made that argument about him saving capitalism, it's like Arthur Schlesinger's argument, you know, and Roosevelt himself said that to some degree, because when he came to power in 33, there was this very real sense out in the country that the U.S. faced some kind of revolution. I was reminded of this recently when I was reading F. Scott Fitzgerald's novel, The Last Tycoon. And I think it's in the very first chapter of that. It's got all these rich characters talking about what they're going to do when the class war comes. You know, how they're going to hide out in Wyoming, or how they're going to, you know.
Roosevelt took the presidency in the U.S. in March of 1933. And guess who else took over a country in March of 1933? Hitler.
I think was that at the same time?
March Violet Revolution.
But that would be.
Let's go to more calls.
That would have been a different guy.
Let's go to Chris.
They didn't get along, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I'm thinking that. Christy in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me. Thomas, thank you for the show today.
Sure thing.
Some comments were made about the occupations that I just wanted to respond to.
Great.
And then later on when you brought up how people live in a world of their own, and I think definitely what's missing from the conversation today is the need for what people on the bottom need to do. And in the occupation, I think the biggest problem was it not reaching into workplaces, and it not reaching into schools, and it not reaching into the hospitals so that it, you know, could actually be sustainable. And I think a big thing that the people on the ground need to do to vote for these people is to start organizing for themselves. And so that's why I wanted to call. I just wanted to bring up that this weekend there's an opportunity for people to do that, to enter into this conversation by actually getting involved with changing the attacks on the public sector and fighting against it. So this Saturday there's a conference at Berkeley City College from 10 till 3. AgainstCuts.org is where you can get more information about it. And I hope people will attend from schools, from hospitals, from workplaces, because in March there's going to be some pretty big events similar to the occupations where people can actually respond and voice and build a movement against the attacks on public services.
Well, thank you so much, Christy. And that's againstcuts.org. We'll put a link to it at yourcallradio.org. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. Let's go next to Bill in San Francisco. Welcome to Your Call.
I got to say, I'm kind of shocked there's been no mention of the Citizens United decision.
Oh, it's there's so much that we're trying to get to. So I'm so glad that you brought that up. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, and I mean, basically, that decision said that you could not, the state or democracy, really, the people could not control the amount of propaganda that was spread. And so if you can't control the amount of propaganda that's advertised on TV, then basically anything can go. You can be the devil, you know, and basically if you're allowed to spread propaganda unlimited, then, you know, it's going to be effective. So it's not really surprising that the right's been as successful as they are. Of course, they're always going to look out for their own interests, but the real factor is whether they can spread the propaganda unlimitedly. There is a movement now to change the
right.
Constitution. If you go to movetoamend.org, you can find out a local meeting place where other people are working to change it, because the political leaders, Pelosi, Reid, Obama, are doing nothing to counter the Supreme Court decision. And so it's gonna be up to the people to change this. Until that's done, nothing's gonna change.
Well, in these most recent Occupy protests from last week, were organized around Citizens United. There is a movement against it.
Yeah.
Well, can I just add? There's two ways of thinking about this, and I actually don't know where I think Citizens United is a terrible thing. But I'm not sure about the exact level of my pessimism yet. I'm still working on that, Holly, about exactly
right.
How bleak
his
the future
cynicism is.
Because I think on the one hand, you know, we were talking about Roosevelt, my great hero, and how money hated his guts.
Yeah.
And opposed him in this huge way. In fact, back then, you know, the idea of the liberal media, this is an invention of our own era. Back then, the media was forthrightly conservative and extremely so. You know, it was in the hands of
people
like William Randolph Hearst, San Francisco's own William Randolph Hearst. And they despised Franklin Roosevelt. And, I mean, the newspapers of this country were against him in this huge way. And he won these, you know, enormous victories anyway. But on the other hand, I think that the sort of the science of manipulation has grown so much more powerful and potent and effective, I should say, over the years. You know, you look at the way Mitt Romney was able to bury Gingrich in Iowa under just that mountain of money.
Except Santorum actually won Iowa, right?
You know, that's right. But Gingrich didn't. That's right. Santorum did. Maybe the victory of Rick Santorum is really a clarion call for, you know, for grassroots movements or something like that. I don't know. But it is extremely disheartening, you know, that money can just, you know, I often think, do you remember about 10 years ago, Karl Rove and all the various Republicans, everybody was looking around for some way to permanently change the political equation in this country, some way to give Republicans, they used to say, permanent majority. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And everybody was worried about it at the time. Well, this is it. You know, Citizens United. This is it. Money is you know, it's a constitutional decision that has completely changed the playing field.
Well, let me bring something up about that, because in the 2000 election, the left and Ralph Nader called Bush and Gore Tweedledee and Tweedledum. And, you know, I don't think that that's true. I think a Gore presidency would have been strikingly different than George W. Bush, especially when you think about the long term effects of Supreme Court appointments,
yeah.
For example.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, I mean, that's what got us Bush v. Gore, and
yeah, that's right. That's I think that's probably right. But also Ralph Nader at the time was. I mean, nobody had any idea, you know, how extreme Bush would be, and the war on Iraq. I mean, you know, just pick a fight with a country, you know, that hadn't done anything, or
we'll talk about being not listening to facts.
Yeah, exactly. In a, you know, that's where that term reality-based community comes from. But then again, I mean, to take it up to our own time, Obama and company were completely blindsided by the fact that the right could divorce themselves from George W. Bush just like that. And what I just did there, listeners, was snap my fingers. I know you couldn't see that. But as soon as Obama is in, the bailouts are done, they're like, George W. Bush, we kick him out of our movement. He is no longer a conservative. We hereby excommunicate him.
Well, they actually say he wasn't a real conservative.
Right. That's what I mean.
Yeah.
Yes. They just immediately kicked him out and said, nope, here we go, further to the right. An amazing thing that they did.
You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and joined by Thomas Frank. He's a columnist with Harper's Magazine. His new book is Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Times Swindle and the Unlikely Comeback of the Right. I want to get to more calls because we have a lot of people on the line. You can join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. The toll-free number again is 1-866-798-8255. One of the questions is, how can people take back the power of their government and begin to solve this huge wealth gap and restore kind of a rational public conversation? And what do you think of the Tea Party movement? You can join our conversation with Thomas Frank at 866-798-TALK. Again, that number is 866-798-8255. And let's go to Craig in San Leandro. Welcome to your call, Craig.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I've got sort of two ideas that they could turn into stories or something more. One is that with the reference to Gingrich and the elites, you know, conservatives have actually used the concept of elites for a long, long, long time. And for most of that time, they would talk about liberal elites. And someone did a study, Justin Lewis, a guy who's a media professor at UNAS, and he found that, like, in 98% of the time, when they used the term elite, it was associated with liberal elite. Yet, probably the biggest elites in this country are the conservative or the corporate elites. You never hear that phrase ever thrown out by anyone. Anyway, yeah. That history could be pretty interesting. But the other thing I was thinking of was that, you know, in terms of your book, The Wrecking Crew, you could almost do a helicopter documentary of these huge mansions around Washington, D.C., that are occupied by the lobbyists.
I did do that. Wait a second here.
You did a film?
Yes. It's on my website.
Oh,
yes.
Well,
we'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org.
Well, think alike. But anyway, I appreciate your work. And, I wish you could comment on the elitist.
I will, because this is something, as you, I suspect you know, I've been writing about for many years about liberal elites, and basically what the conservatives mean by that is highly educated people. That's who they've managed to convince themselves are the real elites in our society, and professional people especially. And look, there is a lot of logic and reason to that. I mean, there is something behind that. I've been reading for the last couple of days this book, The Best and the Brightest, about the guys who got us into Vietnam. And they were all, without exception, you know, these Ivy League educated, they were men at the top of their profession. They were always men, and they were always at the very top of their profession, and they were great geniuses. You know, they were like guys like Robert McNamara, this highly intelligent man, you know, or McGeorge Bundy. Everybody thought he was the smartest guy in America, you know, this kind of thing. And those are the guys that got us into Vietnam. Okay. Now, the one of the reasons that or maybe we don't all know. Maybe I should make it plain. But the real elite in this country is Wall Street, and it's the very wealthy, and it's people like the Koch brothers. That's who really runs this country, not guys writing for editing a law journal somewhere. But those people who edit the law journal, that one of the great problems with the Democratic strategy and the way the Democrats have responded to the disaster in the last couple of years is that Democrats tend, and I'm talking here about the Washington Democrats, not like, you know, people like you and me, Washington Democrats always go to the, always justify what they're doing by referring to experts and expertise. They always do this. When you think back to the stimulus debate, how large should the stimulus package be? Should it be, you know, I don't know how many billion. Should it be 500 billion? Should it be 600 billion? How big should it be? Without variation, this was a debate that was conducted in terms of, well, economists say this, other economists say that. It never occurred to them, apparently, to go out there and tell the public why we needed to run such a massive deficit and what this deficit spending was going to do for us. They never talked about it in broad populist terms. Always in elite expert in terms of elite
kind of
expertise.
Technocratic.
That's the word. This is my chapter about the Washington Democrats. It's called The Silence of the Technocrats, because that's who they always go back to. Think about the classic example is universal health care. I mean, we're in this incredible downturn. To think that they would have any trouble getting by with, you know, putting through a measure to give Americans universal health care in a situation like the present. It's unthinkable. And yet they almost didn't do it.
And that's a big rallying cry is roll
that's
back
right.
Obamacare.
That's right.
And, so how do you explain
about,
that?
Well, think about how they tried to sell it. This is where the origin of Pity the Billionaire. I was driving along a very scenic highway somewhere to the north of here in an undisclosed location. And I was listening to satellite radio, and it was one of those town hall meetings. You remember this, the 2009, the town hall summer, when these Democratic legislators would come home, senators and congressmen, and would be talking to their constituents about the health care measures before Congress. And the audience would typically be filled with conservatives who were very, very angry. And they would be yelling at the member of Congress and saying, what about freedom? What about liberty? You know what? You know that they wanted to talk about really basic questions. What about big government? Okay, and the Democrat on the hot seat, and I listened to a bunch of these, but it was that first one that really got me. Would always go back to, we need to do this because the experts say we need to do it,
as opposed to talking about the people losing their homes because
or
of,
people are being ruined by this. This actually increases your freedom. This is precisely where you want big government, and no, big government isn't a Nazi tyranny. It's
the military.
It's democracy.
It's us,
and there's all sorts of checks, and anyhow, they never did this. They could not fight for this thing in an ideological way. They completely lost that battle, and they were just beaten back further and further, and retreated. It was what a disaster! All because they continually have to go back to the authority of experts. They walk right into that elitist critique every single time.
And let me read an email and go to more callers. This is an email from Cannoli, who says, there's a very nice woman in Seattle who is often called the first Tea Partier. She speaks about local government and bringing government closer to our community, a kind of direct democracy. When I listen to her, I could join the Tea Party. But she supports the Tea Party, which stands for domination of the government and economy by centralized corporate capitalism. How have people like her come to trust centralized corporatism and hate centralized government?
It's really easy. The idea, it's not really easy. I try to put a name on it in the book. I call it market populism. It's a way of exalting the common people by imagining that they speak through the market. If you ever read Ayn Rand, the Atlas Shrugged, which is another sort of important strain in Pity the Billionaire. But the idea is that markets are a natural institution. Markets are kind of made by God. Markets are set up by God. Market rules are enforced by God. And markets speak with the vox populi, with the voice of the people. So a billionaire is a much more effective spokesman for the common people than, say, a president.
And let's go to Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger. We're running out of time, so if you could be brief, that'd be great.
Yes, thank you, Holly.
Yeah.
I think the main reason that Republicans and conservatives appeal is because of their simple aggressiveness. It's like Mike Tyson against a Harvard professor. People just identify with the aggressiveness, and Republicans epitomize that. And it's wrong, and it's ignorant. But that's what works for them. So,
well, let me get a response from Thomas Frank.
I don't know, Mike. I think you need to pity the billionaire. I'm thinking of the cover of Weekly Standard a couple months ago that showed the Koch brothers being burned at the stake. Because people say mean things to them, and I think that they're not aggressive. That it's that the world is mean to them. Remember,
but
in Atlas Shrugged,
Gingrich is surging. I think. Precisely because of this aggressiveness.
People like it. People like a bully. Okay, look, I'm trying to have it both ways here, and I think the conservative movement tries to have it both ways, and I think that they are successful with that. But they love bullies. Look at Ann Coulter. I mean, look at all the various personalities that this movement adores. Each bully more vicious than the last.
Okay, so we only have a couple minutes, and I want you to leave us with a little bit of hope here. What's your prescription?
I'll see you later, Holly. Bye.
All right, come on.
Okay, what's my prescription?
Take off your cynical hat and give me some hope here.
Okay. I'm not going to give you hope. I'm going to tell you my idea of how to make things happen differently. Go back to the 30s, your favorite decade and mine, and the reason Franklin Roosevelt did all the great things that he did, and the reason why we mark him as the greatest American president, is not because he was a great man whose heart was in the right place. That's all true. But he was also pressured from the outside all the time. The labor movement, guys like Huey Long, the Townsend plan for old age pensions, all of these these political clubs all over the horizon. Barack Obama, similar thing. I've met that man. Very intelligent guy, super articulate. You know, I would like to like him. I used to like him a lot. You know, I'd like to see him do the right thing. But I have a feeling that he is in the grip. I know for sure that he is in the grip of the Washington consensus. And the only way that he is going to be moved back onto the paths of righteousness is if we organize outside the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party does not speak to popular anger by itself. It has to be led to that point. And that's up to us. That's up to your listeners. That's up to people like me. And so that's the next step.
And so specifically, what would you encourage people to do?
What should I say? Write to your congressman? I think it's... now you're laughing at me here in the studio. Look, Occupy Wall Street is a really good start, but it has to go much, much, much further.
And do you think that they have a coherent message?
Not at the moment, no. And we were going to talk about the similarities between them and the Tea Party. We never really got around to it.
We didn't get around to a lot of stuff.
Yeah, but there's all sorts of really curious ways in which they and the Tea Party are echoing one another. I mean, even to the point of there's a lot of confusion in both movements. What I would like to see, they have to somehow reach out to labor, okay? What is missing in our country today that was present, you know, in previous decades that changed, really made the conversation different, was organized labor. Now, I don't know whether the union movement can come back in the state that it's in now. I mean, it's just taking this incredible beating all over the country.
It's been eviscerated during the last 30 years.
Yeah, and just in the last 2 years, it's like the right wants to close the door on them. They want to, you know, go in for the kill. And I would like to see them come back. I'd like to see Occupy Wall Street go from strength to strength. We shall see.
And we're going to have to leave it there. We've been speaking with Thomas Frank. He is a columnist with Harper's Magazine and author of Pity the Billionaire, The Hard Time Swindle, and The Unlikely Comeback of the Right. He also wrote the book What's the Matter with Kansas? We'll put a link to web resources at our new website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for your calls and emails, and I really apologize that we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and here's what's coming up tomorrow. How serious is the escalating tension between Iran and the West? On the Next Year Call, we'll have a conversation about the recent round of sanctions on Iran. In response, Iran has threatened to close the Strait of Hormuz, through which nearly 25% of global oil supplies pass. How are the sanctions impacting Iran's economy? Join us live at 10 or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. How alarming is the standoff between Iran and the West? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or daily newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Pete Misek is our web editor. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was performed and composed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.